If I ask you to cup your hands at the place of your deep heart, where are you going to put your hands? And Murshid, you know, when you look at pictures of an icon or in the drawings that were given to the prayers, you know, often his hands are just cupped here. And then always from that point, you kind of finish with, amen. So it's like the rising of that energy, the disbursement of it, and then the description that's given, your hands go out like a bird about to take flight, you know, with its wings. How sweet is that? So let us begin with the Sufi invocation of Pira Murshid Anayat Khan. Towards the One, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being, united with all the illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of Guidance. And let your hands raise up. And pour over your entire being and through your being luminosity, light. So yesterday we were talking about simplicity, and we were talking about how if something seems too simple, we'll dismiss it. But it was also we were also given some of the teaching about truth. We can either think it's so deep we don't even begin to search for it, or we dismiss it as someone else's being. And we were taught, Murshid was giving us indications about uncovering the divine truth within. And Murshid Hidayat this morning said it very beautifully, that it's always there. It may be covered. And of course, that's what our practices does. It helps us clarify, you know, if the lamp is sitting in a globe and the globe is very dusty, you just need to clean it a little bit. And therefore, our purification practices and all the practices really help in that clarification. So it's not like there's anything tarnished about us, and yet the impressions of life, or one may say lifetimes, are there. And so when we kind of can thin that veil or make that globe a little clearer, then that light shines through that's always there. We don't have to put it there. You know, it's there, right? We know that. It seems simple, but do we do it? Right? So I'm going to backtrack for just, I'm actually continuing from yesterday's class. And again, you know, just take a moment to sort of tune in. Murshid was talking yesterday. We brought up these ideas of beauty and truth, and how do we define what is beauty and truth? Is it an external quality? Is it an internal kind of radiance that comes through a countenance, a beingness, and truth? You know. What is that for us? And if we look back over our lives, has that truth, you know, does our understanding of truth, not that it shifts, but maybe it broadens and deepens. You know, we just gain a more comprehensive, open view about it. So Murshid goes on in this teaching and says, many ask, what was the reason at the back of manifestation of creation? The reason is beyond all reasoning, he says. The reasoning is beyond all reason. There is no reason. It is nature itself. Love cannot but manifest. Love cannot help but manifest. It is in its nature. When poetically expressed, the great ones have said that God was lonely. And in order to realize his, her, its predisposition, which is love, in order to experience it, things were manifested. It's like Murshid Hidayat was saying today, the eye cannot see itself. And God in this way wished to be known through manifestation. It will become clearer because the teaching goes on. It is poetic and it is true. But the process of manifestation can be understood by knowing the nature of manifestation. Remember yesterday I said I had things highlighted and underlined? This is the part. That the spirit is likened to the sun. And what we call souls are the rays of that spirit. Continue underlining. If the spirit is eternal, then the souls are eternal. Continue underlining. If the sun is eternal, the rays are eternal because the sun and the rays are not two things. Rays are the unfoldment of the sun, and souls are the unfolding of the spirit. So it's as if there's this, you know, we have the sun in its sort of unmanifested state, and then, you know, the rays of the sun, and we're traveling on the rays of those sun, each one of us. We're bringing our attunement to that source, to this earth, into manifestation. Like this morning we talked about Noor Nisa, how she was born, she had a purpose, and she returned again to the source. And that's what we're doing. Okay. Now here's the thing. Those rays aren't, you know, like out here. They're connected always. We have to remember that connection. Sometimes we forget. I'll tell you when I forget, when I think I'm in control. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I have this plan, that plan. And then I say, wait a minute, I have an inverted thinking going on here. What I really need to do is tune into that source and bring what needs to come at this moment, you know. But it's not always easy. If one's clear or has those inner demands moving forth, we may not be so clear about what that is. It's the art of listening, really. Listening to the spirit of guidance. Spirit of guidance. Some of you know we've been working with that Wazifa Hadi. Yeah, Yahadi. So you might want to make note of that. Tuning to the guide, the one true guide, that spirit of guidance. Hadi. It's not going to be part of our ongoing practices. You know, Murshid Avira, Pir Vilayat, Murshid Hidayat, all of them always said it's good to not be attached to even the practices. Some people are given a practice, a lifelong practice. Some people are given training in learning the different sacred names. But I was always assured that once the wazifa or the sacred practice is done, it continued to circulate. It's not like we're doing the practice starts doing us, whether or not we're aware of it. It's in there, and it's doing its work. So we're going to work with the practice again, Yahak, the truth. O divine truth, the one true reality, not two, one. And let's use this visualization that Murshid has given us and visualize the sun and us traveling on our own ray of that sun. And although at times we may feel the sun's here and we're out there, never forget there's that connection. And it's a matter of where this end and this end may seem like a polarity, but they're part of the continuum of the same and one source. So when you're polarized, yesterday Murshid Kabir said it very beautifully. He used the word inspiration is like the opposite of aspiration. You know, that we can use that to lift our consciousness. So by use of the breath, we can also use it to find that contact, to travel to the connection. So we're going to think about this idea that we're connected to this radiant sun, and you may visualize that even within your own being. Or you can visualize it as something external. I think we at times experience it both ways. Sometimes we feel it arising from within, and sometimes it may be something external that we're yearning for or reaching. However that it arises for you in this moment is perfect. Do you have your beads on? Do you have your beads with you? Do you want to count for us? Okay, so we'll do 34 aloud with Yah, Huck, and then whispering in and out, 34, and 33 with just on the breath, more and more subtle.
Yah, Huck.
Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yah, Huck. Yeah, Huck.
Huck.
Whispering?
Okay.
Oh, inhaling and exhaling, right, Guyon? Is that our next round?
Inhaling and exhaling.
Thank you. Thank you. Yahak. It may be useful to you, it may be not, but I have these, you know, sometimes I see these little images inside, or, you know, almost like little cartoons or something that happen. And what I was seeing when we first started the Yahak was like, you know, trying to strike flint to get a spark, you know. It's kind of a good image to think about, you know, that divine spark. And then I don't know what they're called. They're, remember those old-fashioned, they were kind of, I'll draw it. This is the point where the air comes out, and they kind of look like that. And you, a bellow to fan the flames, right? So it was like, when we're doing the breath, you know? And then it was like, and then I could just see these two little guys, you know how they would do this on the train tracks? You know, and I was like traveling there, and then I was coming back again. I was traveling there, and the breath was helping me. So those are sometimes little images that come up that can be helpful. They give a tether to the mind, you know, to use. So thank you for assisting there, Gaihan. Any other things that came up for anyone else? Any questions or thoughts, too? Yes.
For me, there's the with focusing on the solar plexus, a real feeling of that vibration starting to clear away denseness. And so that phrase from the prayer, raises from the denseness of the earth, kind of came.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It feels like it's breaking it up.
Yeah.
Just,
yeah. When when we would do retreat with Pir Vilayat, he would make us, you know, it'd be days of working with the zikr, and we often did it, part of it kneeling, like the, you know, the, and he would use il instead of el, but il Allahu, but it was like hard, like we were supposed to go all the way to the ground, you know, it was like doing these prostrations, you remember, and I was like, you know, it was like really hard, and he said, it's like a hammer coming down, crunch, you know, breaking that, you know. I mean, he said, breaking that ego, you know, he was really into that. Hadayat would tell us, well, the ego gets treated a lot like a doormat. We don't have to think of it that way. We could think of it as a, you know, there's as a beautiful adornment on the door, you know? I mean, it's like, you know, beautifying the ego so it can function in its true purpose to help navigate through the world or express that divine ray in the world, you know? So there's different points of view, you know, and there are different places for it, too. In retreat, you can completely break it apart, but let me tell you better assemble it again or they're going to be putting you in a straitjacket somewhere. So, yeah.
I had a question.
Yes.
About what you were talking about, how Murshid would
put his hands
here. Sometimes I feel like that's almost like a protection. Like sometimes if I'm uncomfortable, I stand.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Like with my arms across the kind of the solar plexus area.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was more like a, you know, it was more like a cupping. Here, so it wasn't so much like this, but a cupping. And even in the prayers, you know, a lot of the gestures of the prayers are here at this, down here like this. But I think that's true. I think people do block that. It's interesting to watch people's body language.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if it was the same emanation, just in different...
No, I think one is we could... I mean, when someone does that, that really says something, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yes?
Yesterday you talked about the location, male versus female. I didn't know how far up.
No, it's just this distance. You put your fingers like this. No, you put your fingers like this. And for the woman, she puts her thumb in her belly button and goes down, and that's the very root. And for a man, he puts the forefinger in the belly button and comes up, and that's his is a little bit higher. That's the root, the very, very root of the heart. And then Murshid was talking again about this, the flesh of the being, our physical heart, is like it picks up the reflection from what's arising from here. And, you know, Murshid has this whole body of teachings on the mind, the feelings, and the soul, and how these are different vehicles. So we, this is, could be considered, you know, kind of the soul center in a way, and then this is the heart center, and then this other mechanism gives voice to it, the mind. But he always says the deepest aspect is feeling, our feeling, stronger than thinking, much stronger. So Murshid goes on to say, every soul has been projected as a ray from the spirit, and it must pass through three spheres. These three spheres are angelic realm. The next one coming down is the jinn realm. And the next one is the physical. We could almost think of it body, heart, soul. Could be those three layers. Okay. Maybe love, harmony, beauty. You know, it's those three. Murshid explains a little bit about what that means. Do you all know about the jinn sphere?
No.
Okay. Let me skim here and see if he talks about it. The jinn sphere, they would say, is the realm of... Murshid Aviri used to describe it as the realm of genius. And she would often give the example of Einstein and Stephen Hawking. And she said, imagine that Stephen Hawking's ray is coming down. It's penetrated the angelic realm, and it has penetrated through the jinn realm on its way to Earth. And Einstein's journey is returning. It is in that jinn realm where that knowledge can be transferred for the work to be continued on Earth. So these parallels of, you know, continuation of study or music or art, you know, that this knowledge can be passed there. Now, of course, if we think about the spirit and the rays, we can always go up there. We can always go up to those spheres of inspiration and knowledge and bring it back down, manifest it. It's a very beautiful thing to think about. We can also enter those angelic spheres. Sometimes we get into that state in a zikr or a deep practice, you know, or communion with nature. It can happen. Right? Breathing into the nostrils of a llama, right?
A horse now.
Or a horse now, yeah.
And that's where the horse identifies
people. Yeah. That communion. Is that clear what that means? It's J-I-N-N. It also means like genie, genius, that realm. I can't decide whether I need my glasses or not. I put my glasses on, I can't see up. My eyes must be a little... Okay, this is better, I think. Sometimes, this is so interesting, sometimes the soul remains in one sphere longer than in another. It remains, or it goes further. Just as some of us in art, in science, in learning, in the pursuit of knowledge, go only so far and not further. So it is with souls. Those which are satisfied with one sphere remain there. They may behave like any creature of lower realms would. They eat, they drink, they make merry, and be quite happy. There are others who feel uncomfortable until they penetrate through another sphere where they are more contented. Some are not satisfied in that sphere either, and they look for another sphere. This is really interesting because, you know, I hear from sometimes from people that they don't feel like they belong here. You know, they feel disconnected. It could be that some part of their being, if we think about it, we have the physical body, we have the emotional body, we have the body of the appetites, we have the body of the mind, and we have the body of the spirit. Sometimes we're synced up, But I think sometimes we're not. And there may be part of one being that maybe is in another realm, and we're kind of, you know, things are not as they appear, nor are they otherwise. Time is not linear. Space is not linear. We could be sort of in these different places. It's interesting to stop and look. If you feel a little disconnected, it happens, yes? Think, wait, am I in the in-betweens, you know? And if I am, what am I aspiring to do? Or what am I inspired to do? Sort of look at that. If we can be objective, I think it's really healthy. You know, then we don't get caught in the subjectivity. We can be get involved in the objectivity and look at it and learn from it. It's a lesson. It's a great lesson. It's a great opportunity to learn. So think about that. I also do believe that we can be communicated with from these different levels. We can tune in, and beings can tune in to us. Sometimes there's information that needs to come, and we can be the messenger, you know, for tuning in. Does that make sense? You've probably had that. You maybe call it an intuition, or something arises, or even a deja vu. You can tell it in people's countenance. Sometimes you look at someone and you say, oh, they're an old soul. You know, they've made the journey a lot. But other times you look at people and you just get this sense that maybe they've got a lot of jinn in them still, or a lot of the angelic realm in them still. They're not quite... It happens in photographs. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed that? Some people are standing right next to each other, and one person, it has nothing to do with the photograph, they're fuzzy and the other person's very clear. It doesn't take a mystic to see that. It's objective. Notice that about yourself sometimes. I see it in my own photos. It's like, whoa, I'm sort of in the, between the molecules there. You know, it's like, pay attention. It's all there. Communicating. Any other comments? So think about that, sort of that yearning and that feeling. And if you're stuck, maybe it's being a little stuck in one of those realms, and you can kind of do a practice, the breath, yahuk, to kind of help create movement. We human beings here have the tendency, and it is also the tendency of the soul, whatever it finds of interest, joy, and pleasure, it remains. It settles there. But again, every soul is bound to its goal. It must reach there. And to reach the goal, it must return. It's kind of an interesting... Like, what is that circular thinking? Wait a minute.
Can you please read that one?
I think I should read it. It's another one that I have underlined. Mm-hmm. Every soul is bound to its goal. It must reach there. And to reach the goal, it must return. It's like a koan, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It seems directional, doesn't it?
And why go out in the first place?
It's an inner cosmology, really, isn't it? But again, it's back to that. This. Going back and forth from the ray to the source. The ray to the source. Returning. Return again. Return again. Return to the land of your soul. The land of your soul. Do you know this song?
Yes.
Return to you are. Return to what you are. Return to where you are. Born and reborn again. It's like that. So in order to reach the goal, we also have to return to the goal. It's not a line. It's like a water wheel. Rumi talks about the water wheel. It's like that. How amazing. I mean, you know, it's like these moments where I really want to get up and start doing cartwheels and things, because it's like, oh my God, right? It's really kind of like, aha, yeah, okay. I think it's extraordinary. It's simple, and yet it makes one really have to think and be involved, not passive. So Murshid goes on to say, when returning, it must give back that garb to the same sphere from which it was borrowed. It's unlearning. Selflessly giving back. Nothing belongs to us. That's also an illusion. We recognize this as death. Since man does not know his soul and is only acquainted with the garb, when the garb is given back, man says that is the end of life. But in reality, it is only the beginning. Just another act of the play, which is the further journey it must make. Now here I thought again, okay, what is it really Murshid's trying to tell us? Is he talking about the physical death?
He's talking about all of it.
What does that mean, all of it? The Sufis often say, die before death. Die before death. So I thought it might be helpful to read another segment from another body of teaching. It's just a paragraph. Can I do that? Because I think it helps to illuminate this passage. And this is now from Sufi Message Volume 6, The Pearls from the Ocean Unseen. And Murshid says this. The philosophy of resurrection, point of fact, through death the soul enters the higher sphere of existence freely, and that is the meaning of resurrection. But there are two aspects, the negative and the actual. I kind of was thinking about this too, and it will come to me because I had another word for negative, because I think we have kind of things associated with negative. One might say the... it'll come. There's another word there that we could use. But let me just go on with his own words. The negative resurrection takes place when we pass to the higher spheres of existence in the lift, which is like an elevator, in the elevator by the means of the breath. How illuminating. Again. Or... I'm getting there. So the negative resurrection takes place when we pass to the higher spheres of existence in the lift or an elevator by the means of the breath and hold on to the rope. We're here and we're holding on to the rope, the physical body. And come back to the first floor on earth. What an amazing image is that? The use of the breath, we allow ourselves to ascend. We're staying there while we're still holding on to the body. And then return again, like an elevator, coming back to earth. But having this knowledge that we've made in this journey. It's alchemy, really. It's an alchemical process of kind of unraveling and reassembly, you know?
That's like
I forget which time you talked about this, but we can go into the past and retrieve a disturbing thought or feeling and take it into our present when we know, have more knowledge and appreciation, and then let it go or transform it.
Yeah, or project it into the future and with the knowledge of the future transform the past.
Yeah.
There's how you use it too, in a very practical way.
That is.
You know, if you have a wound that you just can't, you know, it's like a groove. Marcia talks about the lines in the mind are like a groove and we keep falling into it. And he taught, and the whole idea is that by thinking about the past, we can draw that into the present, or one could call it the eternal moment, because really that's all there is, now and now and now and now and now and now. And then we project that into the future, and with the knowledge and understanding of the future, we bring it back into the eternal moment and project it into the past to help heal it. It's really amazing, and it can be done. I'm a testament to it. I know this. Because if one can't do that, then one is always a victim of one's circumstances. Yes?
And is that not finding the story beneath the story? Is that what you're talking about?
I think there's stories beneath those stories, too. Even Arabi, one of the great Sufi philosophers, said, seek to know that which transpires behind that which appears. You know, Karima Gita, who knows me about as well as anyone does, she will hear me say, when something really difficult, challenges happening in my life, is it not true that I always say, this is really good for me. I'm learning. I'm learning. This is up for me. This is for me to just be with, feel the energy of it, and to understand life better. You know, I'm learning. It's okay. It's a schoolhouse. This is an opportunity. So Marcia talks about this process of using the breath to connect to the higher spheres while remembering that we can always be tethered here in return. And then he goes on to quote the Quran, where he says, this is the meaning of the words in the Quran, die before death. This negative resurrection, that's what he's talking about, is the teaching of the Sufis and is the whole object of the contemplative life which they lead, which we lead. It takes away the fear of death because we've experienced it then many times. And death becomes the bridge that unites friend with friend. Or friend with friend, you know? Right. Friend with friend. Jesus, when passing from the earth, left behind his physical body forever. And that was his positive resurrection. Who was I talking to? What was I? Oh, I know what I was watching. Does anyone have Amazon Prime?
Mm-hmm.
Have you watched the Vikings?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I'm like totally loving that. Of course, I've watched the other side from the British, you know, the English point of view, and it's really different. But it's so interesting. Whoever's telling the story are always the really handsome, you know, dignified people, and the other ones are the gross, icky people. I kind of love it. It's great. It's kind of like watching, you know, NBC and Fox at the same time.
Yeah.
Look back and forth. Was I political? No. Okay. But there, they think it is such an honor. I mean, they really, there's an old warrior in the Vikings. This tells the story. And he's like, he's really old, and he's been a warrior and traveled, you know, on the ships and done battle, and he goes to now the new earl, and he says, I really want to go with you, and they're sort of looking at him and saying, well, maybe there's something else you could do. And he said, listen. And what's their god called? Thor?
Odin.
Odin, thank you. He said, I've gone. Yeah, it's true, isn't it? And my husband told me that it didn't stick. Don't tell him, I don't always pay attention.
It's our secret.
It's our secret. But anyway, he was saying, you know, I've gone to battle many times, and I haven't been given the blessing to be taken to Odin. I really want that opportunity. And when people have passed in that show, they think it is just the greatest thing, the greatest freedom and glory, you know. And they even have the human sacrifice in that. That's also so honorable, you know. People want to be able to do that. It's a little scary to think about it, isn't it? But you know, it was part of the culture. I mean, we don't understand it. We're not part of that tradition. But, you know, it shows that aspect of life, that kind of honor, and there's not fear. It's that surrender. If any of you have had or been with someone, you know, that going through a near-death experience or being with someone in their moments of passing, you can see the release. All the pain and all the struggle's gone. They almost, their faces are transformed like into an eternal countenance. It can be very extraordinary. So there's something to it there. For me, at least, I've been witness to it enough to think, to believe that very much. So let's, again, do the practice Yahak. And Nayan, do you want to guide us again, or Habiba, do you want to try?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Okay, instructions.
34, okay. We'll do aloud with Ya.
Uh-huh.
34, you know, you just go up your bead till you hit your big bead, and then you go to the next one till you hit your next big bead. We'll whisper inhalation, exhalation on Huck, and then silently, just on the breath. And you can just let us say Ya Huck when it's over for us. Okay?
Yahak,
Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, Yahak, whisper.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, be prepared if you take up the practice. It will manifest in your life, and you will find that the truth of your own being will become revealed, sometimes in startling ways, at startling moments. But it's worth the journey. Yeah. Those of us that have worked with it know of what we speak. It's like Mercha to diet. Purva Light always said that. Never give a practice that you do not know the effect. You have to be very well acquainted with it. So, you know, that's also something that, just a word to wise, don't just pick things up without consultation. No self-prescriptions, prescribing. Yes?
How many times do you do this in the practice?
101 times, and that's why people are using their beads. It's given in a way that it has some mystical meaning, which is connected to Islam. There are 99 names of God. There's one hidden name. And so, but one would never stop with the even number. The one is like to begin the next cycle. So it's like the next breath. But we stop at 101. Now, I have revealed to people that... you know, I was very proud of myself when Murshida Vera started giving me practices and asking me to do them 501 or 1001 times. And then I read in some of the old papers by Hazrat Anayat Khan that was to be given when people are very stubborn. So I thought, oh, I'm so advanced. And then I thought, oh, no, she was trying to break through. So.
Murshida?
Yeah.
These aren't my usual beads, and I just counted. We were 6 short the first 2 times. So what does that mean? We did 28 repetitions. Are we very not stubborn?
That's it. That must be it. That must be it. Yeah, some people also, you know, because we have the Tibetan Buddhist beads for sale, and I've been traveling with people in India, Sufis, and they're like, oh, these have 108, or sometimes when they put 3 decorative beads at the middle of the mala, you know, there's 111, and it's like, who doesn't fall into forgetfulness on 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 of those beads? Use them. Be quiet. Yeah. Well, I use them both because I do, you know, I'm a real rainbow path person, so to speak. But so this is a Buddhist mala, and it's set up in the Buddhist way. It's different. You know, it has 4 sections of like 28. But I also use these little markers that mark it at the 11 and the 33, so I can use it for both, you know. You can, you know, just be smart about it, right? If you feel like that's important to you too, you can do that. But okay, so now we're going on, because now this is really great. Are you ready? Let's figure out who each one of us is now and maybe at other times in our lives. So there are 3 different ways of returning, Murshid says. Or one should say 3 ways of going forward. One is the way of the drunken man. Or woman. Another is the man or woman who is asleep. And the third is the way of a man or woman whose eyes are open. Now, Murshid goes on to explain this. He says, the way of the drunken man is the general way. What is life? Life is drunkenness, intoxication, right? We get intoxicated with so many things in life. And he goes on to say, whether a man is in business or amuses himself, one wonders exactly what he's saying there, but whether he is in a profession or has any other interest in life, what is it all? It is wine. He is drunk. Afterwards, he knows nothing except for that particular intoxication. He is intoxicated by the life that he has led. That is the world. Ambition, aspiration. He is taken back against his wish like a drunken man. This is the way that a soul goes towards the goal. So when we're returning, how are we returning? The second way, then there's the way of the person that's asleep. That person knows not what death and life and birth mean. They do not know why they've come here and why they're going away. They're happy because they're asleep. He is taken wherever he's taken. You know, very kind of mercurial. Oh, I ain't like this. Okay, now I'll do this, and now I'm going to do this. Oh, you're going there? I'll go there, you know. The third, there is a way of a man who journeys with open eyes. The one with open eyes will see all the beauty on the way. He is the one who will enjoy the journey, who will appreciate the beauty of traveling. For him, every step forward provides a new experience, a greater joy, a particular blessing. He experiences the dance of the soul. And what the dance of the soul is may be understood by watching water in a tank and running water of a stream. In the tank, it is stagnant, dead, in the same way that a person can be dull, heavy, and depressed. The water of a running stream is dancing at every step, and the dancing soul attracts everything towards itself like a stream of water. And what will bring pleasure and satisfaction to all who can see. So this is a good imagery to work with. You know, sometimes we feel like that we're kind of stuck and we're stagnant. You know, it's not even clear water. It's just, you know. And then all of a sudden there can be movement. There are practices for that too, you know. You have to talk to your guide and ask. That's what I was saying. Sometimes we have to ask. I've actually had students of other teachers come to talk to me because they don't want to tell their own teachers that they're going through certain troubles. Your life is your practice. If your teacher doesn't know, then your teacher can't help you. Your teacher isn't judging you or think you've done something wrong. You know, it's like Compton Rinpoche used to say, I mean, I've told you this story. I'm so sorry I keep telling my same old stories. I have to find some new ones. But, you know, while at the monastery, you know, my front door to my little room was right next door to the room of the residents, the front door of the residence, and people would come all times, night and day, with their troubles, and they'd of course think I was the attendant and knock on my door to get to Rinpoche, and then I'd always have to go ring the bell and help. But I'd say to Rinpoche, you know, how do you manage all of this, you know? And he would just say, each person that comes before me is like a great, great gem. It's like they provide a stepping stone in order that I can help them towards my own enlightenment. You know, it's really an act of generosity to ask someone to help you. It helps them build great merit. We don't have to do it all ourselves. Sometimes I'll have a student that's had a difficult situation arise in their life and they're crying and they want to run away, and I said, but we're all here for you. And that there isn't one person in this room that doesn't know how you feel. At the college, you know. And if you want to share, if you're comfortable, share with people. The fact is it creates sympathy in their heart, and that's a beautiful thing. That's a beauty in and of itself. You're giving them a gift to feel and to support you. So, you know, it's a matter of perspective. Murshida Dayat says, you know, happiness is within. And it doesn't mean everything goes easy, for God's sake, I know that. But what's the hidden benefit in all of it? I told Rinpoche one time, I was single at the time. I had been single for a very long time, 13 years or more. I mean, really single. And I said, I sometimes think I'm all alone, and it's so wonderful you have, your attendants and all these people around you, and he said, do you know what freedom you have? You get to go to bed when you want to go to bed. You get to get up when you want to get up. You can eat what you want when you want to eat it and go wherever you want when you want to. You don't have, it's just that, you're free. Don't ever, there's always a way to look at it. I'm either very lonely or I'm very free. Do you see what I'm saying? When you know God is looking at you, you don't need another person in the world to see you. God sees you. I think that's why people come into coupleship sometimes. They need someone to be a mirror. But God is always there. That's the greatest companionship we can ever have, the greatest refuge you can ever have. And dogs?
And a horse.
Oh, and a horse. Well, and dogs. Again, don't tell that to Joe.
Can I share just on that?
Please, please.
In our most recent round of practices of the Yahadi, I often have a problem going on that I would be holding in mind while doing this practice, and I would be like, well, what else should I be doing here? And many times got this message, well, you're doing fine, but just don't forget that God is here, and that I could be, don't have to necessarily do any behaviors differently, but I was very much forgetting that the presence of the divine has a comfort and a presence. And so when I would do that, then that would go through my day, I'm much more aware of that. And it was like just something for me to work on.
I think that's really insightful, and I think that that's part of, and some of you know I have this new role, and people will say, well, how are you handling it, and what are you doing, and how does your day look? And I always say, I'm listening. Yeah, and those that have known me for long periods of time know I'm really a doer. So it's really changing things for me. I'm really trying to listen to this spirit of guidance. And also listening to timing. Because there may be a really perfect course of action, but there's also a perfect time for that course of action to happen. And if it happens too soon, it's not going to go well, and if it happens too late, it will not go well. It's tuning in and listening. It's hard for me because I'm very, I'm always, Kareem and Geeta and I compare our Fitbits, and it's like, we're maybe together the whole day. Sometimes when we're traveling, she's like, how in the world did you, and we use the same kind of contraption and everything, and it's like, how did you get all those extra steps? And it's like, I'm always moving. And by the way, with your practices, you don't have to, I'm like the Energizer Bunny, and then I go, but with your practices, I do a lot of the practices walking the dogs. And so I'm not walking around the neighborhood going, yuck, 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 yuck. But you know how it sounds. You can do it inside. You can hear that sound inside, too. So you don't have to do that. Again, 911. If someone... We don't want any calls like that. So you can hear it inside and do it in that way too. Yeah. Another good one when you need to release, because it's energy. You're frustrated, it's energy. You're angry, it's energy. It's any of that, it's energy, right? A really good tip is you go and drive your car through a car wash. The windows are all up. It's very loud. No one can hear you. And you scream all the way through. Seriously. Yeah. It's like, if the dogs are with me, it's like, what's going on?
I have a question though about you doing your practice, because this is one of my deals. I very much identify with what you're saying about being movement and walking the dogs and all this, and that's my morning. I mean, I used to, before I had the dog, I would do my practices, sit down, do music, all this other stuff. Now the dog wakes me up and it is time to go. We're not just going to the yard. We're going somewhere. Adventure.
That's
now,
right.
How do you do your practices with beads as you're walking?
A lot of times it's beads, or I know that
my method.
Yeah, the Sura uses her fingers, I often use the bead, and I have two really big dogs, so you can imagine. I try to get them in one hand, and I'm. But And I think, I think it's so good. I know people often, and I think that's really good for retreat. I think we have to learn that. We have to set the proper atmosphere, and there's that whole thing about the cushion, the atmosphere, the everything. But life isn't like that. I think we practice in that way, but then we learn how to be able to use those practices in the moment. And I have found, for very practical reasons also, I've had energetic experiences that rope is very, and sometimes I get up and I can't come back down, and for practical reasons I would have to conclude my practices and go work and stuff. I couldn't just be dangling up there. So and also there was a, I could have an energetic experience and tremble and things, So I just realized it was Mercia Tadai that helped me realize it was a compression of energy. So moving for me helped to circulate that energy so I wouldn't have those breath work, also the zikr of an icon, but the motion also helps me a lot to move that energy so I don't have those energetic constrictions and then have those reactions to it.
I was thinking when we were talking about practice while walking a dog or anything else, or driving a car, although maybe that's not the right place. Is that if you can't do your practices other places, you have to have your cushion, you have to have the, then it becomes like a spiritual attachment.
Yeah, it is.
Like
it can be.
It's really, you're more attached to the ground, the whatever.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Spiritual materialism.
Exactly.
Shogyam Trungpa Rinpoche talks about that.
So I was walking down the streets in Istanbul a long time ago, and I looked around, and all the businessmen in their suits are walking around with little, and then they run into each other, and they continue while they're having the conversation. Yeah. And I'm a super hyperactive person, and if I'm sitting and listening to a lecture, I get out my beads and I do a few.
Yeah,
but
it helps.
If those businessmen, I can still picture the couple of them.
Absolutely, absolutely.
All of them are always doing that.
Yeah. And I shared that at the abode when we were at the Federation, because people are really in a quandary, and they're concerned about the world today, and who hasn't been in all of history, but it's there all the time, 24/7 in the news, and so that I've told you, I get up in the morning, I watch the news and I do my practices, and then I keep dedicating them. The other thing, I used to be shy about sharing that, but I had my Rinpoche visiting America. He was touring and he stayed with me. I gave him my home to stay in. It's like, you all stay here, I'll go stay at a neighbor's, But I would go back and forth between the houses and we'd have breakfast together. And one day I walked in. He had the news going. He was on my exercise bike and he was reading, his... is the sutras, the Pesha. And he was just and I'm like, okay, you do that. I said, you do that too, Right? I said, oh, me too. And he goes, there's a lot going on. But it's the really high beings. They're right here, right now, and they're just, there's no pretense.
Yeah.
No pretense. I remember one time, Sogyal Rinpoche was going to see, I was in India, and I recognized him. He was in a taxi, and he was going up to see my Rinpoche, because my Rinpoche is the lineage holder for that, the Nyingma tradition. And he was had invited other lamas in. They were having like a little conference or something with the monastery. It's like, oh, Sogyal Rinpoche, I know you're going to see Kompto Rinpoche. I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but I just want you to know how much your writings have meant to me, and I know so many other people in the West it's meant so much. And he just reached out, and he said, oh, very good. You know, I'm going to see Kompto Rinpoche right now, right? You know? And it's just like he was in the moment, you know? And how are you? Oh, okay, maybe we can talk later, but I have to go now. I have an appointment, you know? And it was just like, it was kind of like, no, you know? I mean, they're just right there. Gosh. You know what? It's time for the class to be over. Stay tuned. I didn't get through today's class either. May all beings be